Earlier this month, increased digital surveillance capacity was handed to law enforcement agency when the Identify and Disrupt Bill, Identify and Disrupt Bill, for heaven's sake, was passed through Parliament. There was very little media coverage and, sadly, little pushback from the opposition to this legislation. This is just the latest national security legislation to be passed in the Australian Parliament, adding to the more than 90 pieces of security legislation that have passed through since 9/11. What capacities does this latest addition give to law enforcement, and should we be concerned? And is there anything that can be done about it? To explain it all, I'm pleased to welcome back to the program Lizzie O'Shea. Lizzie is the chair of Digital Rights Watch, an organisation committed to defending the digital rights of the people of Australia. Welcome back, Lizzie.
Thanks so much for having me.
First, can you give me some background to the latest legislation, so beautifully called Identify and Disrupt? What's it hoping to achieve?
Yeah, well, you're right, I think, to start by putting it in the context of over 90 pieces of legislation since 9/11, 20 years ago. And this, I think, is perhaps the most serious. I'll put it out there. Essentially, it creates three warrants, although I'm a bit hesitant to use that term because I think it gives a bit of a false impression. There's a data disruption warrant, which allows agencies to add, copy, delete or alter data on devices. And then there's an account takeover warrant, which does what it sounds like. It allows Australian Federal Police and the Australian Criminal Intelligence Commission to take control of accounts, including to lock out the account holder covertly and without their consent. And they're not warrants because they can be circumvented. It may not go before a judge if there's an emergency authorisation provided, if it's not practicable to go before a judge. So I'm not sure that they're truly warrants. And the third one that's called a warrant in this particular bill is called a network activity warrant. And that's not for using or creating evidence to be used in court. It's allowing access to entire networks where there's a suspicion of a serious offence for intelligence agencies to surveil those networks and use them for intelligence capabilities.
So if a crim is using WhatsApp, the law enforcement can access all of WhatsApp.
That's right. So the bar is very low for agencies to get access to an entire network. To my mind, what this sounds a lot like is the PRISM program that was run by the NSA. I mean, that was warrantless bulk mass surveillance, and that caused outrage when Edward Snowden revealed its existence. But essentially, what's been introduced with this Identify and Disrupt Bill, now Act, is it's a program for agencies getting similar bulk access to networks for intelligence purposes. And that, I think, should trouble anybody who uses the internet, that essentially you could be scooped up in this, notwithstanding that you may have, there may be no reason that you should be suspected of committing any kind of offence at all. So essentially, we've got a warrantless regime here for surveillance and also suspicionless surveillance. There's no need to be suspected of committing an offence.
Now, so all the same threats are there: terrorism, child abuse, organised crime, but there's every opportunity for quite spectacular mission creep.
Indeed. I mean, I think one of the things we've learnt in recent years about intelligence and law enforcement agencies is that they'll say that this is only going to be reserved for the most serious of offences, and then it turns out the laws aren't drafted that way. And then what ends up happening is what people like me and my fellow critics of these laws, our worst nightmare, which is that they'll use it to its fullest capacity and there'll be very little oversight over how it's used. So, you know, I think there's laws that may be needed by intelligence and law enforcement agencies, but they should be drafted specific to that purpose and no wider. And the problem is no one seems to be asking these questions in our institutions, including in our parliament, as to why such broad powers are needed. And as a result, it's just this endless slide away from a rights-based society and towards mass bulk surveillance.
Explain to me about data disruption warrants, about how agencies can copy, delete or alter data on devices.
Well, to my mind, what this is setting up is a system for essentially state-sponsored hacking. You know, people will read in the news about various cyber attacks and who they might people might be speculating who's responsible for that. And often they talk about countries like Russia or China engaging in this kind of warfare, really, cyber warfare. And I think what the data disruption warrant, allowing agencies to go in, add, copy, delete, alter data, allows those agencies to conduct similar kinds of activities to those organisations that might come out of places like Russia and China, which we're often very critical of. So I think this is a bit of a wake-up call. We're often very critical of other countries who we suspect might be committing acts of cyber warfare and state-sponsored hacking. And I think what a data disruption warrant does is it allows an agency to do those very activities.
Talking to Lizzie O'Shea. Now, they're called warrants. Are they what we would understand to be a warrant that a judge would need to sign off?
Well, the first point is about all of these is that they routinely will go before the Administrative Appeals Tribunal, which is not a court, doesn't have the same rules as a court, and has been criticised. Christian Porter was criticised for appointing a lot of people to the AAT and needlessly and inappropriately politicising the body. But I think there's a real risk that the AAT might not be in a position to do a good job here, not because they've got ill-qualified decision makers, but also these are very complex decisions. You're figuring out how a system might work, what kind of risks are posed by authorising a particular kind of behaviour or one of these so-called warrants, and they may not be in a position to be able to assess that evidence effectively. So it's generally going to go before the AAT. To my mind, it sort of sounds a bit like the FISA courts in the US that were used by agencies there and exposed by Edward Snowden. They become rubber stamping authorities that essentially do what agencies ask them to do. And that's a structural problem. There's no one there. There's no public advocate there to represent the public interest to say that this should be limited or that there's technical reasons why this is problematic. In fact, all you've got is the agency showing up and asking the AAT to approve what they're doing.
Now, clearly, the Australian Federal Police and Australian Crime Commission can use these warrants, but what about international agencies?
Yeah, so we're obviously a member of the Five Eyes Intelligence Sharing Agency, so that's the Anglophone countries, Canada, the United Kingdom, the US, New Zealand and Australia. And we have also seen in recent times legislative instruments introduced to facilitate a greater sharing across that intelligence alliance, including this bill, which includes provisions whereby foreign people may be surveilled, of course, given how broad the warrants are and what they allow agencies to do, and that's accounted for. And there's no problem with that. It's legislated for and it's anticipated, I would say, because of that. And then there's also other legislative instruments, including a law passed recently where the United States, for example, can share intelligence across borders with us and we can do the same. And in fact, there's real questions about whether that's constitutional from a United States perspective, because it may violate constitutional rights. But in Australia, without any human rights regime, our lawmakers face no such difficulties.
Are there any reporting requirements on the use of the warrants? Can we know, at least in due course, whether they've been used or not and what has been the outcome?
Yes, indeed. So there is thankfully some reporting requirements to the minister, who then has to table these in Parliament. There's also a role for the National Security Legislation Monitor that does some of this work monitoring these things. What I would say about the monitor is I think largely does a good job in many respects, but he's not always listened to, as you can probably imagine, by an ambitious government.
Grant Donaldson.
Yeah, and there's been a few different ones. So there's been other national security legislation monitors prior to him who also made recommendations about, you know, the reform and the need to reform surveillance powers that have largely been ignored or certainly not implemented. So the tradition has been that the monitor does raise concerns, but they aren't necessarily addressed by the government. So reporting is one thing, but actually turning that into significant reform or addressing the problems and weaknesses in a particular piece of legislation is quite another. But what I would say is you started by talking a little bit about how there was little opposition, and it's largely true. I mean, the parliamentary processes on this have just been appalling. You know, a lot of the bill that we were talking about, the Identify and Disrupt Bill, flew through both houses in kind of 24 hours. It was tabled earlier, but, you know, no proper debate, in as you might expect on a bill of this significance. But there is a lot of public opposition. You know, there's a petition online that arose when this bill was passed, and there's nearly 125,000 signatures. So there's a clear disconnect between the parliament and what it's doing, the various monitoring bodies and reporting bodies, and what the public think. I think it's fair to say the public is a bit concerned about this and not necessarily satisfied that the checks and balances that exist for agencies using these kinds of powers are sufficient.
Lizzie, how does all this link to the telecommunications and other legislation amendment, TOLA, that was passed in 2018 in great haste?
Great haste indeed. So the TOLA Act, the Assistance and Access Act, people might know it as well, it's essentially a piece of legislation that allows agencies to break encryption. And that was a kind of targeted set of powers to go to tech companies and build essentially a backdoor into encrypted communication systems for particular kind of projects that they have in mind. We were very concerned about that because once you weaken an encrypted system for one purpose, that weakness can then be used by anyone once it gets out in the wild. We have to be very careful about deliberately building weaknesses into our digital infrastructure just for the purposes of law enforcement and national security agencies, when that may put our digital security as citizens at risk. That was quite targeted, even if it was very dramatic and severe, and we were very concerned about it. This Identify and Disrupt Bill, now Act, I think is the next iteration of that, which moves it into a more bulk setting where mass surveillance is possible. And, you know, they've still got the tools that came through TOLA, the capacity to infiltrate encrypted networks and force companies to break their own encryption to access further information when they need it. So we're looking at very expansive powers now at the disposal of these agencies.
Human rights activist and cybersecurity expert Manara Sharif was on the program recently talking about Pegasus and compared the laws to what is permitted in Saudi Arabia. Is that a stretch?
I don't think so. I mean, I think it is telling that out of the Five Eyes Intelligence Alliance that I was talking about before, Australia is really the weak point when it comes to rights. We don't have a rights regime. I think other agencies, our equivalents in our counterparts in the US and the UK would look at this with, you know, some jealousy, what the agencies here are able to get away with, that, you know, you don't have to contend with constitutional rights like they do in the United States or Human Rights Act like they do in the UK. So we are a weak point. We as citizens are vulnerable to very serious laws being passed here that I think put us at risk. It's really building into our digital infrastructure tools that suit national security and intelligence agencies without necessarily considering the importance of digital security for citizens.
Lizzie, you mentioned Edward Snowden in passing. How does this capacity for mass surveillance compare to what NSA was doing under PRISM, which, of course, Edward revealed?
Yeah, indeed. So PRISM essentially was where the NSA was getting essentially a live feed straight out of tech companies and using that for intelligence purposes. And they were doing that without a warrant, of course, and that was part of the scandal. This, I think, sets up a program or the capacity to do the same thing. You know, I think that it's very problematic that they're essentially forming a legal regime to do something that caused immense outrage when it was revealed. You know, when Edward Snowden revealed the PRISM program, people were really appalled that an agency would seek to hoover up all our communications and then make use of it as they would like, that you couldn't expect to have private conversations on the internet. And it's partly what prompted a huge amount of encryption as standard introduced by various platforms to protect people making communications from those communications being accessed by someone else, including national security agencies.
So there'll be significant impact on whistleblowers and journalists.
Indeed. But, you know, the other thing I would say is it's not just those people. I think we all have a stake in this. You know, one of the other scandals that came out was the WannaCry ransomware attack, which was a ransomware attack that affected
I'm sorry, would you repeat that?
It's the WannaCry ransomware attack. So people may remember there was a ransomware attack a few years ago which affected tens of thousands of computers around the world. Computers in the NHS, ambulances were being diverted, medical records couldn't be accessed because ransomware, what happens is the criminals lock you out of your computer until you pay a ransom to get back access to your data. It turns out what happened was that ransomware attack emanated from a weakness in Microsoft systems that the NSA knew about and chose not to disclose to Microsoft to fix because they were using that weakness for their own purpose. They were using it for intelligence gathering and the like. They lost control of that. It got out into the wild and got into the hands of criminals, which was then used to wreak havoc on computers around the world in this ransomware attack. And what I think that highlights is the interests of national security agencies are to keep these access points, these weaknesses in our systems to themselves or build them in the case of TOLA and use them for their purposes. But that may in fact put us all at risk. We're all dependent on digital infrastructure to do lots of everyday activities. And if those systems aren't secure, we're at risk of all sorts of bad behaviour.
So strong encryption systems actually protect citizens from criminals.
Exactly. I don't think we talk enough about digital security. We talk about national security and the needs of agencies, but we don't talk about how its citizens have a right to expect that their digital infrastructure will be secure. We're dependent on it. We use it for banking. We use it for health services, for, you know, public transit, for power supply. You know, if we're engaging in state-sponsored hacking against our supposed enemies and we're building weaknesses deliberately into our systems that could get out into the wild, it's only a matter of time, I think, before those things get turned on us. And, you know, agencies doesn't seem to bother them. They're more concerned about their own interests and they don't necessarily think about the citizens that they're supposed to serve. And they don't think about how digital security is something that we should be factoring in to how we're making policy in the space.
There are a couple of ways that security legislation is already moderated and monitored. The Parliamentary Joint Committee on Intelligence and Security, the Independent National Security Legislation Monitor, and that's been in place since 2010. How effective has this been in protecting the rights of the individual?
Well, unfortunately, I think the National Security Legislation Monitor does do important work, but too often the recommendations by that office are not taken up by the government. So there's a weakness there because even though they're independent, there's no real spirit of compliance on the part of the government or an interest in taking up those recommendations. So I think it's important work, but it's insufficient in this context. The Parliamentary Joint Committee that you mentioned, that's where traditionally national security legislation goes to be reviewed. But again, in this instance, that committee made a bunch of recommendations that were largely ignored. And that committee is made up of the major parties and not other representatives from Parliament. So they're often locked out. So one of the ways that Parliament does achieve scrutiny and accountability is by having people who aren't from major parties critiquing and raising points in public debate. That's largely prevented from happening by the functioning of the committee, unfortunately.
I'm going to ask you a Dorothy Dixon, and I suspect I already know the answer and I don't like it. Has there ever been national security legislation that has later been rescinded?
Not that I know of, but what I would say is there are sunset provisions attached to this legislation, which is a good thing. So we've got 5 years to talk about this and, you know, the security agencies have 5 years to discuss or justify why these powers ought to remain. So there are lots of pieces of legislation that have these kinds of sunset provisions, and I think that does create an opportunity for us as citizens to start raising debates and concerns about these things. I'm a bit concerned that those sunset provisions tend to result in a renewal of the legislation. That's the general history in this space, but that's by no means foreclosed. So this is our chance to kind of do something about this.
Okay, in 60 seconds or less, any way to get around the legislation to keep your online activity safe from prying eyes of government?
Well, there's lots of things you can do. You should think about introducing two-factor authorization, basic security measures like that. If you have to have a really important conversation, if you're a journalist, you should probably try and do that in person. And if you've got particular concerns, there's lots of resources online, and I'd point you to our website and we can point you in the directions of the right ones.
Blessings upon you, Lizzie O'Shea. Chair of the Digital Rights Watch and Human Rights Lawyer. Koala stamp, another one I think I've given her.